So, Peter, you've written an article on something I've never even heard the word, and it very well might be a neologism, as far as I know, but maybe not. And it's the concept of followership, which I have to imagine is the converse of leadership. Can you talk to me about this?
You are absolutely correct. It is the converse. It's not a neologism. It does exist, but it isn't surprising that even a man of your great esteem hasn't heard a great deal about it. I hadn't heard much about it until recently. It's a bit like old Justice Potter Stewart and his, you know, knowing pornography when he saw it, but not knowing how to define it. But it is probably the converse of leadership, and it's a darn important thing, given that 80% of us are better described as followers than leaders.
Yeah, that's probably true. And so, and you know, this article is fascinating because this wasn't just like a editorial discussion, you know, we're bad, blah, blah. This was actually a data-based article, which you wouldn't think on a topic of this.
Certainly not with my name on the article. You're right, Scott.
So what was the intent and what were the findings of this article? And then we could talk about it in a broader sense.
Absolutely. Well, big shout out to, first of all, to the first author, Caleb Leung. And I think it's brilliant that a general surgery resident's first big publication is on followership. You know, that busts a whole bunch of stereotypes right there. So essentially, the idea is that there's an excessive focus on leadership. And what we found was that there were 60 items on leadership for every one on followership. Now, 80% of us are best described as followers, and we certainly were at some point in our career, and we are at some point in our day, whether it's in meetings, whether it's even at the clinical cold face when you need somebody else to do something, or let's be honest, it is when we go home at nighttime. And so with 80% of us playing a certain role, isn't it shocking that nobody's talking about it or attacking it as a science?
100%. Yeah, that's as I was reading, I'm like, wow, this is both fascinating and very worrisome that I've never put even the smidgen of mental time into like pursuing the ideas here.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. Now, both terms, leadership and followership, are difficult to define. It's certainly not as binary as it used to. It's not an all-knowing giving an order. That's not leadership anymore. And it's not an all-submissive taking an order. That's not followership anymore. And the two things are fluid. They define each other. You move in and out of these positions. But you know what? I think we've actually done ourselves a bit of a disservice by focusing too much on leaders. And could you, I've been to plenty of meetings, leadership meetings. I do some work with a leadership college. Can you imagine a followership college? Would anyone donate to that? And that's a really important issue when so much of healthcare is just doing the boring bog standard stuff right.
So what makes a good follower?
Well, it's the same thing that makes a good leader. It's emotional intelligence. It's being able to move in and out of leadership positions, followership positions. It's assessing a situation and saying not what do I want out of this situation or what makes me look good in this situation, but it really is good old-fashioned putting the patient back in the middle and saying what do they need, what's the best role I can play at this current time. And it is fluidity. It is moving in and out of different roles. Now, there are models. There are psychological models. As you know, psychology is obsessed with the 2x2 table, and no different here. But that's essentially what makes a good follower, somebody that sizes up a situation and says in the moment what is needed.
Well, what are you say 2x2 table, which makes me assume there's four various forms of followership. Could you elaborate on those? What are the options?
With pleasure. the most quoted example is by a gentleman called Robert Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y. And it's a 2x2 with a fifth right in the middle. So basically, the 2x2 is, do you exhibit independent critical thinking? The opposite being, no, you don't, more dependent uncritical thinking. And are you passive or active? And so the 2x2 goes from what they call sheep, basically people who are uncritical, uncreative, and unfortunately, as a result, unproductive, through yes people who are They're certainly active, they're certainly engaged, but they don't show much critical thinking. To alienated people, which I think is a very interesting thing when you look at doctors, they're very capable but cynical. They're loners, but they have a lot of influence. And then the ideal is the effective or exemplary. However, even here, there are downsides. These people are very principled. They get stuff done. But you know what? They really don't like autocrats. They really don't like being told what to do just for being told what to do's sake. And so, you know, again, I think that has a useful reflective role within healthcare. Now, the fifth one is the pragmatist that sits right in the middle. And depending on whether you want to consider this a laudatory or a lamentable personality trait, these people are survivors. They're flexible. They look at the situation and they size up what it needs. It means sometimes they don't speak up, but it also means they don't just disrupt just for the sake of it.
Now, when I was reading this, this is where we get into the stuff that I find fascinating, because what they did not have as a rubric for this table and this various characterization is whether the people who are following and being critical are actually right or not. Because that would be the key, right?
I think that's a brilliant point. And we can't talk about this without talking about culture. And in addition to that, every single one of these adjectives can be either seen as a compliment or an insult. You know, to be somebody that does what is required versus being a sheep who doesn't speak up, we could potentially be talking about the same person. It's that old Indian parable of the blind people touching the elephant, and one touches the trunk, one touches the tail, and they come up with an entirely different animal. So the fascinating part to me becomes how situational it is. You can say, well, in a healthcare situation, I don't really care about your feelings. The patient needs the following. Or in a less acute situation, well, just a second, we need to maintain a relationship, so I'll let this one go, but not the next one. And back and forwards and back and forwards. And it sort of brings us back to how important a relationship is in the type of medicine that you practice, and how much you can work without a relationship. In other words, can you run down to your emergency bay with people that you haven't yet met and dive into action? And if so, how do you do that? And so these models, these 2x2 tables, don't give you all the answers, but they do give you a fantastic opportunity to just reflect on how good not just your leadership skills are, because that's beaten to death all the time, but actually how good are you at following or assisting?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Let's look at it from both sides, because this is where it really gets interesting to me. So, you know, you've already touched on the most difficult situation for leadership and followership, which is the ad hoc team. The team you haven't trained with, you don't know their names. It's just a new group of people. And we'll add one more complexity, which is we're going to put varied services in there. So the followers may not be from the same department or group as the leader. And so now you don't know who these people are, and they already have a different set of mental values and ideas about how things should go. How do you be a good follower when you don't respect your leader? What is the way you should handle that situation?
Well, as you can imagine, I've never had personal experience of not respecting my leaders. How do you deal with that one? You know what? This is where, to me, followership is a very relevant thing. And you could, I guess, say it's a leadership quality, and then we're stuck in this whole what means what. But you know what? What does the patient need? This is what the patient needs. Therefore, you know what? I don't have to be the person that intubates this patient. Is no different than, you know what? What does this patient need? This patient needs me to put up with this surgeon who, you know, otherwise I would happily beat to death with a stethoscope. But for the sake of this patient, we'll be task focused rather than ego focused. And I think that's another sort of paradigm within leaders and followers, is whether you're task focused or ego focused. You know, me saying what the hell's going on, I can change the inflection in my voice so that that is a very accusatory, what the hell's going on? And I'm trying to be the leader. I'm trying to be all ego-based to, what the hell's going on? In other words, what do you need from me? What's going on? How can I help? This is a tricky one, isn't it? So I guess that is where you bring your best self to work. You have to put up with people you don't like, because a lot of medicine's a marriage that you're stuck in and you're not getting out of it. So you got to work through it.
No doubt. But let me acid test this, because I think that is a bad follower if you're going to let your personal feelings influence how you behave in a resuscitation situation, for instance. But it becomes a more questionable circumstance when it's actually care that's being impacted. So I'll give you an actual example. And this, of course, has never happened in real life. This is purely theoretical. But you have, for instance, a trauma surgeon, and you've come down as the anesthesiologist to the case. And this surgeon's kind of junior. So, you know, junior in their attending or consultant level. So they're scared. And this is very commonly exhibited by surgeons by becoming very vitriolic and angry. And they say, I want this patient intubated. And you're a good follower. So you say, absolutely, regardless of whether you think it could wait a few seconds or not. But you say, okay, I'm going to intubate this patient for you. But then what they don't realize is that intubation, when done properly in a really sick patient, requires a few minutes of preparatory time to make sure it is safe. You want your first attempt to be the right one, and you want to account for the patient's physiologic circumstance. But they look up after 20 seconds while you're still getting your equipment together and giving maybe some medication to augment the patient's blood pressure and say, why is this patient not intubated? How does a good follower handle that, knowing that if they capitulate, they're actually doing wrong by the patient, and yet they could easily provoke a fight in this person who's just really teetering on the edge of a cliff already?
Absolutely. That doesn't sound at all hypothetical. That person is clearly a douchebag, and your job is not to tell them at the time, because then you will spin off into an ego-based, willy-waving fight. How do you deal with that situation? I don't want to disappear into cliches, but you realize that your job is to find time and space. Your job is to diffuse that situation. And your job is you know, graded assertiveness, closed loop communication. All those ideas can be applied in a crisis where you say, yeah, absolutely, it is going to take a little bit longer than you realize. Bear with me, though, because I'll need your help as soon as the tube's in. And you know, you slowly grade that up. Now, the interesting thing is you are the follower, but you're not the follower, because you know what? You're the person putting the tube in. And right now, if he wants to do his surgery next, he's got to have you do your tube first. And you'll switch in and out. I mean, to me, it's where it becomes fascinating, the predefined hierarchies versus the sort of ad hoc hierarchies. And that can change between countries. I know some of our anesthesiologists, when they move down from Canada to the States, do notice there's a bit more of a hierarchy between those specialties, rather than one person who deals with airways and one person who deals with scalpels. So, you know, you've got to know your local culture. You've got to be a presence within your hospital. I think that's one of the things that younger trainees do need to appreciate, that if they get annoyed that I can get my way, it's not just because I'm 220 pounds and grumpy. It's also because but that doesn't hurt. But I've been in that hospital for 30 years, turning up on a lot of Saturday evenings to help out. So you're building currency all the time. I think you're absolutely right, though, about that cliche of the junior surgeon coming down. Now, you know, just to caveat, we have all sorts of fantastic surgeons, junior, senior, and we have just as many people on our side of the docket who are exhibiting that behavior. I was taught in medicine there are only three emotions that really matter: fear, greed, and fear. In other words, there's only two. And you know what? A lot of the time, chasing that fear is often a much more useful thing to do than just doing an arms race of anger. I don't know whether that answers the question, because you can't answer how do you get difficult people to work together, except that you do it every day and you practice it just as much as you do putting tubes and lines in.
Yeah, you know, you brought up two things in my mind, one a recollection and then one a further question. And the recollection was at, I think, the second SMAC conference, Karen Brohe, trauma surgeon extraordinaire, and someone who I doubt has any problem leading resuscitations in the right way, because I doubt he's afraid and he has the mental stamina to care about his team in addition to the patient. But he made a statement that I thought was one of the highlights of the conference for me. And he said that during a trauma resuscitation, there could be only one leader. Mm-hmm. But who that leader is varies throughout the entire resuscitation.
Isn't that marvelous? Yeah.
And that's the crux. And that's the whole thing, is that during that airway management, you really own control of the situation. You could tell the person who's trying to put an IV line in but interfering with your visualization to stop that. And you, that giving the reins of control back and forth to various team members depending on what's being done makes a whole lot of sense. The second part is, and you alluded to this, is that a lot of these problems of followership come with ambiguity of who actually is the leader. And it seems like in America, at least, we keep building in these situations with inherent ambiguity, that when the trauma surgeons come downstairs to the ED and they're taking care of a trauma resuscitation with us, for some reason, a lot of places leave it intentionally ambiguous. They don't beforehand. And would it irk the emergency staff if they what was worked out by the two chairs was that trauma is always in control? Yeah, they might, you know, burn their butt a little bit. But then it solves so many other issues. And I'm not saying it should go that way, but one way or the other would be so much better than the situations we're often left with, which is no one really knows who's in control. And then it becomes the most aggressive, loudest voice in the room that just by de facto takes control. But then you have a lot of followers that are in a disgruntled state. How do you feel about that, Peter?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, everything you've said is top notch. And just to reflect back on my reality, I mean, you knew a pompous former English schoolboy like me was going to throw a bit of Latin in here. I mean, there is an old line, primum inter pares, which basically means first amongst equals. And so, yes, we absolutely do take turns being the first amongst equals. The military is better at this than we are, but you know, you've talked about system one and system two attention, or this reflex attention versus this more sort of step back and think about it. You know, in trauma bays, having a line of tape on the floor is not a bad idea, so that when you're over the line, you're doing stuff, and when you're behind the line, you're thinking about stuff. And that helps tacitly work out who your leader is at that particular point. I think we need to grasp that your strength is also your weakness. So up in my part of the world, we are quite polite. Now, this is a spoiler alert here. Canadian politeness is often passive aggressiveness. Yes, but your strength is often also your weakness. So we're very good at flattening the hierarchy right away. The danger of that is diffusion of responsibility and who the heck is in control. And you'll excuse my schadenfreude, but to actually hear you say the same thing about where you work, you know, first of all, busts a few American cliches, and it's about time those were busted, but also sort of brings home exactly where we are with this followership leadership thing. I maybe 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't easy to define then who was in control, because people had all sorts of sneaky ways to influence. But I think there was more a sense of, I'm now going to talk in a very loud voice and you're going to do what I say. And then after the fact, you're not going to get upset and or report me, and we'll somehow stumble through. Now, things are different now. I don't think they're entirely better, and they're certainly not entirely worse. I think they're somewhat better because we understand this. But what, if I heard you right, you brought up the capable but cynical person, the person who, the sort of loners who have influence within their system, and what Kelly refers to as the alienated. And I think this is a lot of doctors. It's probably a fair number of nurses, but I've never been a nurse, so I can't speak to it. But if we're not captured and engaged and brought into the system and we don't feel valued, then we will unfortunately turn all of that creative energy into being the guy that just goes, ugh, this sucks.
Yes.
Or you know, do whatever you want. I don't care. And in fact, it is a very passive-aggressive thing. But it's a very significant issue within our systems, because followers still exert a lot of influence, even if they don't have the biggest badge on or the longest lab coat. You can still influence the culture. So those people, you have to capture their 10% of expendable energy and engage it somehow. Whether it's, you know what, You've got a lot of passion, go teach these people. You got a lot of passion, go research. You got a lot of passion, go administer. Or you know what? You've got too much passion, get out of the hospital and you know, re-equilibrate yourself. I think those alienated people, that feeds into burnout. And that's, by the way, one of the other areas where followership and leadership styles are finally going to get a bit of attention, because they do influence the culture of the hospital, which in turn influences burnout, which in turn influences your ability to change things for the better or the worse. So I think that alienated group are incredibly important. I also think, by the way, the conformists, the yes people who will do just about bloody anything as long as they feel like they're part of the gang, part of the tribe within the hospital making the decisions, that those people can be dangerous too. So, you know, like everything in life, it's the extremes.
Absolutely. And let's talk about that alienated group, because there's mm-hmm. two various time points at which they become a problem, especially if they're smart and right. And you're absolutely correct. If those people aren't given opportunity to voice it during the situation itself, they're certainly going to speak about it afterwards. And that leads to these back channels of discontent and tribalism and all sorts of bad stuff. So one thing that both you and Chris Hicks have mentioned in your various articles on how to run a resus from the communication side is these regroupings or sit reps or time where you could step back from a dominant leadership style and actually ask, does anyone in the room have any other thoughts? And now it's kind of an open forum for those people who were alienated while they were being in a more directed receivership role of being told exactly what to do. That might give some vent to those feelings that the things are going wrong and I'm not being given any voice to be able to say it. And if those people don't speak up but are given an opportunity and then still badmouth the entire resuscitation and that leader, then I think it's all on them, because they had the opportunity. If they're ignored, fine. But I see a lot of the people, and I don't know, would you characterize this in your 2x2? Are these the passive people? Is passive and active whether they're willing to voice it? Or is that what that refers to exactly?
Yeah, that's a good point. This wasn't designed, this 2x2, for healthcare workers. It was designed for business, actually. So I suppose, again, it goes back to how you want to define things. We could call it passive. We could call it active. I mean, I don't know what you're like, Scott, but goodness me, scream and shout at me anytime. I know that one. I know how to deal with that one.
Absolutely. So
the passive aggressive can be much more powerful. I think it's a good opportunity for you and I to shout out. I mean, you mentioned Karen, and you're absolutely right. The stuff he talks about is fantastic. Cliff Reed is fantastic on this stuff too. You know, you and I were very lucky to be somehow involved in his hard work, not yours and my hard work, let's be honest, on the 0-point survey, on the idea of getting a team huddle beforehand. And I think that's finding time and space to do that is a fantastic way to engage people, to make them understand that even if every word isn't listened to and every loop isn't closed, that they're still part of the team. And you know what? The debrief, the hot debrief and the cold debrief after the fact, is another opportunity to keep those people engaged. Doctors have a lot of creative energy, and they can either use that creative energy for good or bad. And I once heard our job, and don't put too much stow in this expression, but I once heard being a doctor described as a third-rate job for a first-rate mind. Mm. Now, you know, it's a bit self-congratulatory because most of us aren't first-rate minds, but it does sort of suggest that you take these very independent lone wolf people, and they became successful by knocking aside the competition. And it's me, if I fail, it's me, if I succeed, it's me. And then put them in a very bureaucratic system where you're forced to work in teams. You know, if there's 180 steps per patient per day in the ICU, and that's the estimate, then you can't do it all yourself. So you have to work in a team. But at the same time, we can't have too many yes people. And this is the friction that probably does always have to exist, but also the friction that causes a heck of a lot of problems. I also once heard doctors as described as healthcare workers who are authorized to work outside of guidelines.
You were the person I heard that quote from, and that was another phenomenal moment. I'm like, yes, that was absolutely so important to say.
Well, it belongs to Julian Behan, or at least, you know, and then he heard it from Hippocrates, and Hippocrates heard it from, I don't know. But what's fascinating about that to me is that as a result, the doctor's not always going to follow the algorithm, and we're becoming very algorithm obsessed. And so that's going to cause friction if he just says, or she says to the nurse, go on, just do it, you'll be fine. Well, they're not authorized to, and they're not comfortable doing so. The flip side of that is occasionally nurses have to understand, okay, he's going to ski off piste a little bit. That is why we have doctors for those 3-4% of cases that can't just be managed by the algorithm. And so, again, I feel that that's all wrapped up in the followership, leadership, give and take. And you know what? I don't know. Let's not make this a conversation about millennials and generations. But the give and take thing to me is a fascinating one. I do worry that I've been guilty of this, and that others certainly are still guilty of this, that people go into a situation thinking they must win every single battle. They can give no quarter. Not a case of I'm going to be in this hospital for the next 10 years. And as long as I do approximately the right thing for the patient, I will have to give and take. And there's a perfect example going back to your aggressive, stereotypical surgeon that comes down, you know, give and take, give and take. And I've had interactions with surgeons, and I get on very, very well with our surgeons. But I've had interactions where I could have taken a lot more offense than I did. And I'm sure there's just as many on the other side of this docket. I'm sure there's people who could have taken offense at what I did, didn't. And you know what? That was the best thing for our relationship moving forward. And then I realized the next time I came down, or just a second, still waters run deep. There's no need for me to get angry with this guy, because I can get done what we both need to get done with a much gentler approach, and on and on. So this is the reason I find this fascinating. But I do think this paper is interesting, because I hadn't heard the term followership before about 2 years ago, and we're just not thinking that way. You know, we, as I say, we build institutes for leaders, not followers.